The next section that I want to talk about today is a section called How a Zen Trainee Should Behave. This is a very interesting section, there's a small work by Kazon, which is also in Zen is Eternal Life, and it's called Sonken Zazen Setsu, which is translated as the three types of personality resulting from training. And these two sections, how a Zen trainee should behave and how a Zen trainee's personality is after training, are related, and they're interesting in the sense, and I'll just recommend that you read this work by Kazon at some point. They're interesting in that they don't really specify how, you know, kind of in normal terms, you expect, okay, so now I'm going to find out what a Zen trainee is really like, because they're going to describe it, how they should behave, what they're like. And then you read it and you realize my wish was not satisfied. because of what they're trying to point at, the nature of what they're trying to point at. So we'll go into this now. The truth had been transmitted directly to the present time from the time of the Buddhas and ancestors. In all the 28 generations in India and the 6 in China, no thread has been added to or speck of dust taken away from it. After the robe was given to Daikon Enno, the truth spread from one end of the world to the other, and so the Buddhist truth flourished in China. Truth can never be sought, and they who once see the way forget all knowledge and fame, for they transcend relative consciousness. Okay, so that first sentence is useful. He's just kind of saying, really, the truth is all of these people that we talk about, that we learn about, all these people have been practicing the truth. They've been practicing the Dharma. They've been practicing the way of expression of the reality of life. Truth can never be sought, and they who once see the way forget all knowledge and fame, for they transcend relative consciousness. Because it's kind of a difficult idea. Well, if truth can't be sought, what are we doing here? What's going on? And this is pointing to this idea that really the idea of searching for something outside of ourselves is delusory. The idea that we need to find the truth, find something, is delusory, because we have it, we are it, we live it, and it can't ever be lost. That is not to be taken in a simple way. It's not to be taken in a mundane way, because obviously, well, here we are, we feel like we've lost it, or we feel like we can't see it, or we feel like it's separate from our lives. So there is the koan, there is the question. How do we deal with that? Knowing that people like Dogen are saying, well, you can't actually seek for the truth because you already have it. This is the beginning of insight in how a Zen trainee will behave. Gunan was at Obi when Daikon Enno lost his face. Eka, the second ancestor, cut off his arm in front of Bodhidharma. In front of Bodhidharma's cave, thereby gaining the marrow of Buddhism by destroying the selfish mind. Having gained the core of Buddhism, he gained vital freedom. Dwelling neither in body nor mind, and having no attachment, stagnation, or grasping. So here it is again. He's pointing at the mind from which a Zen trainee behaves and the nature of how that behavior will manifest in the world. A trainee asked Joshu if a dog had Buddha nature, to which Joshu replied, "Mu. How can Mu be measured? There is nothing to hold on to, one must just let go. Mu is a character that means no or negation. But what it means, what he's negating, what he's saying no to, what he's saying, and it also means emptiness or the absence of something. What he's pointing to is you have to let go of the question. If you have the question, you don't see the answer. A dog can't have anything but Buddha nature. If you have the question, does a dog have Buddha nature? Then you haven't seen it. So he's saying, let go of that question. Look directly. See what is there. See what the reality of it is. See what the reality of life is. When you do that, you realize, I mean, you may not be even kind of, you know, kind of dramatic or anything, but you realize, well, how can a dog not have Buddha nature? If the Buddhas and ancestors are telling us all things are Buddha nature, well, why should we doubt that? What's going on there? Again, we're back to that question. Why don't I see about myself that I am Buddha nature, that I have Buddha nature? There is nothing to hold on to. One must just let go. That's the central problem of being a human being. We're constantly grasping after what cannot be held on to. And we think it can be. We think it must be able to be held on to. We don't want to lose what we have. We want to get what we think we need. What are birth and death, the affairs of the world, mountains, rivers, earth, men, animals, home? If you continue thus, neither action nor non-action arise as distinct in themselves. Continuing thus, okay, let me stop here for a minute. I read a line in a book the other day, and it said, we think in the West that we have a personality. We have one kind of personality. But from the point of view of Buddhism, from the Buddhas, if you look, and from our own experience, really, if we sit down and meditate, we realize there are a whole bunch of different personalities within us. There are a whole bunch of different kind of ways of being, moods, kind of different people in there, really. And so as an ordinary human being, we identify with some of those, we like some of those, and we try to kind of put those forward. And some of those we don't like, so we try to push them away, we try to keep them, you know, at bay. And then this person goes on to say, the Buddha, the difference between the Buddha and the rest of us is he didn't adopt any of them. He was just himself. He didn't actually make use of or adopt in a kind of long-term permanent way any of those personalities. He lived from this deeper place of meditation. In practical terms, we constantly, it's like that idea of wearing a different hat for the different jobs that you have. You know, we're constantly go through the day and we represent different things to different people. We put on our hat for being the dad, or we put on our hat for being the friend, or we put on our hat for being the person on the phone dealing with business. And we have these different personalities that we kind of go through and move around through. What we're trying to do in Zen practice is to get in there and to allow the idea of just letting go to permeate that whole process, so that we don't necessarily, in a long-term and kind of grasping way, identify with any particular personality that we need to manifest throughout the day. And in a formal sense, this is what becoming a monk represents, or one of the aspects of becoming a monk represents. I say this not to say this is a good thing, I mean this is a thing we should aspire to, but to say this is something we can learn from. So when you become a monk, you have to you are asked to be willing to set aside all of those different personalities and just wear the robe, the form of a monk. Just appear as a monk. So, and what that means is, so one of our personalities might be the self-expression that we have from the clothes that we wear. Okay? What is it? I used to run around in, it was funny actually, I used to wear, my uniform was, my sort of life uniform was Converse All-Stars, Levi's 501 shrink to fit jeans, and a t-shirt, usually colored t-shirt. This is my uniform. And this is the uniform of my friends, or my little clan. I went and saw some of my friends this summer, and we're kind of driving around through to two of my oldest friends, people I've known since I was 15 or 16. We're driving around in Kamloops, and our conversation sort of wandered into the lament about 501 Levi's not being available anymore. And I noticed that they're a married couple, and my male friend, he still wears 501s and jeans and a t-shirt. And I'm sure that that would be the default for what I would wear. That's just what I feel comfortable in. And it's like this sort of kind of this little personality statement, this little like thing. And the woman, same thing. She would just be, she's kind of wearing some like hippie clothes or something like that. So, and these things mark our identity or mark how we put forth an identity into the world. And as a Zen trainee, it is really helpful to be willing to get in there and allow meditation to be in that process so that we don't insist on taking up that identity. And sometimes even to do something a little different, you know, put on a suit and walk around in a suit. Can't even imagine how that would be. But maybe it's like being wearing a robe, I don't know. So when you become a monk, you're basically setting aside all of those worldly identities that you can do, and you're putting on the form of a monk, which has been handed down from a long tradition and is really nobody's favorite thing. I mean, well, there might be some of us who have a lot of monastic karma, and that's where we feel most comfortable, but it's a slightly different thing because it really kind of gets in there to disrupt our personal preferences. On another level, we also have and identify with what we might call gender identity. So I'm a male, and female friends of mine in the past have said, you know, you're really pretty male. I don't really know what that means, honestly. I suspect it means something, and I kind of constantly am willing to let go of that. And of course, I met women who are more or less female, more or less identified with the gender of femininity, gender qualities of femininity. And there's nothing wrong with that, nothing negative about that, except that when we begin to cling to it and insist upon it and identify with that, because part of what that whole realm implies is, the more kind of male I am, the more I can attract somebody that's more female. So there's a whole kind of issue in there about mating and bonding and all that kind of stuff. So again, part of our practice is to be willing to allow meditation to even permeate something as personal as our kind of gender identity. Not that we're trying to become anything else, but just allowing. It's kind of like when you're digging up the ground to plant like a tree or something like that. Or planting a garden. When you first dig up a piece of ground to make it into a gardenable space, you need to kind of dig down pretty deeply and loosen up the ground so that water and nutrients can permeate your earth. And so part of the practice of meditation is to be willing to, as if we were a piece of ground, to kind of loosen up all of those kind of stuck, those kind of heavily identified, packed down gender identities, or those identities, not just gender identities, that live within ourselves. So part of that's a deliberate effort. Like I think, oh, maybe I'll be, well, actually for myself, knowing that there was this kind of issue about masculinity, femininity, I actually went through a period of time in my 20s where I would wear a skirt around the house. I wasn't trying to be a cross-dresser or anything like that, but I just wanted to kind of see what that was like, you know, stir that up a little bit. And so we can experiment with that. Again, we don't need to become something different. It's more like we're just trying to allow that just letting go to permeate all the aspects of our life, all of the different corners of our life. And indeed, the way that we hold on to the idea of being a human being is in there as well, and what we need. So that's another identity that we can allow to be affected by meditation and just letting go. Because there will come a time when we have to let go of being a human being as well. When we're facing death, that will be a thing that we need to be able to look at and let go of. Okay. Again, there's nothing, I'm not trying to say there's anything particularly wrong with any of our particular identities or personalities that we might have, need, or use, employ. Just, it's a matter of how can we allow meditation to take root in those places and allow that mind of just letting go to really deeply affect us. And this is, I think, the idea that Dogen is talking about here. All of these people that he mentioned are people who have been willing to let go of any of their particular identity in order to find what is the most deeply true. So again, back to Gunan was at Obi when Daikon Enno lost his face. The idea of losing your face or discovering your original face is a way of talking about this. We lose our face. We lose the mask that we have been wearing, the idea, the identity, the personality that we've been wearing in the world. And we let that go to discover the most deeply true part of ourselves, our original face, the original kind of person that lives in here. And we begin to learn how to live from that thing. So to use my description of what the Buddha, he was a person who just lived from his original face. Now, it can be, to talk about it in these terms can be a little misleading, I remember, because you might expect, like me, to use my friends again, they might expect me to look, if I told them this, they might expect me to look and be completely different than I was, you know, 30 years ago. Well, I'm sure I am somewhat different than I was 30 years ago, although I'm sure to their happiness and also some to their chagrin, I'm actually quite a lot the same as I was 30 years ago. I mean, irritating in the same ways, I'm sure. So this is not, again, to be reflected on or thought about in a superficial way, because in a sense, our habits and patterns are still going to be there. It's this idea, I think I've used this analogy before, it's like having a brick building in which we have taken all the mortar out. The brick building is still standing there, it still has the same form, you can still recognize the original building. It just doesn't have any mortar in it anymore. So you could kind of push it over or light shines through it. Okay, and that's what we're trying to, that's the quality of life that we're trying to create here in our Zen practice. So again, all these people, Gunan was at Obi when Daikon Enno lost his face. Daikon Enno, you know, one of the six patriarch. Eka, the second ancestor, cut off his arm in front of Bodhidharma's cave, thereby gaining the marrow of Buddhism by destroying the selfish mind. He was willing to, according to this metaphor, willing to even give up his body, you know, the kind of integrity of his body, to find what was true. And hopefully we don't need to do this dramatic thing. how we, again, identify with our body. You know, as many of us here are proving true, we would like our body, in a sense, to be healthy and happy and nice, but in fact, the reality of it is that it isn't. And that's really what we have to work on letting go of, is our wish that it were otherwise than it is, and our identification with the person who we think we ought to be, and just come back to accepting what is really here. What is the reality of this life? What is the reality of this body and mind? And that's the selfish mind that we're cutting off, is that, and in a sense, it's not that selfish to wish to have a healthy body. It's pretty reasonable in the world of things. And yet there is, to wish to have something that we cannot have in the present moment, there is going to be suffering there. And so the more that we can let that go and just do what needs to be done, the less we will suffer. And even our idea of the dog in Buddha nature, you know, what we're kind of, in a sense, saying is we're letting go of our ideas about how Buddha appears, how the Buddha nature appears, and how it can, how it needs to be. Because, say, from the point of view of the body, what we tend to think is, I have to be healthy in order to practice the Dharma and give expression to what's true. If I'm healthy, then I will be able to be, to find what's true and live in that truth. But that's not a true perspective. That's not actually accurate. Buddha nature exists whether we're healthy or not. The Dharma, Buddha nature, the reality of life exists whether we have the form of a human being or whether we have the form of a dog, whether we have the form of an ant or a hungry ghost or a being in hell. Buddha nature exists. It can't otherwise. It cannot. It just can't. What are body and mind? What is Zen behavior? Okay. What are birth and death? The affairs of the world, mountains, rivers, earth, men, animals, home. These are just birth and death, the affairs of the world, mountains, rivers, earth, men, animals, and home. All of these things can be permeated with meditation. All of these things can be responded to from the mind of meditation. That's where we find Zen behavior. It's not in any particular kind of form. It's not in any particular kind of pattern. We think, oh, if I do it this way, if I live my life according to this pattern, whatever that pattern is, then I will find happiness. And the fundamentally, that thinking is flawed. The challenge of it is that there's intermittent reinforcement, because there are certain patterns that we can use which actually reflect, say, 90% of good karma, in a sense. There are certain patterns, you know, like if you exercise daily and eat right, you're likely to be healthy. And, okay, well, so that worked. There's a pattern that I can use. But what Dogen's saying and what the Buddhist ancestors are saying is there's something deeper than that. Because you might be healthy for a while, and that might be good, but you are going to, you inevitably, your body is going to decay and fall apart, whatever you do. So let's look at more deeply at that. Let's look more deeply at that pattern. Let's be willing to let that go, in the sense of, here's something I've been wanting to describe. The idea of letting go. It works best if I have a chair that I can actually lift. Mm-hmm. Remember that letting go of something is not, we think of letting go as throwing it away. Okay? Kind of getting rid of something. But letting go is really like the difference between this, I'm holding onto the chair, and this, I'm not holding onto the chair. Now, when I'm holding onto the chair, it makes it really difficult to get up and go anywhere. I can't go anywhere. Or, you know, whatever. I can't pick up my microphone, I can't adjust the light, because I'm holding onto the chair. I can't function properly if I'm holding onto the chair. If I'm letting go of the chair, I might be sitting in it, I might be making use of the chair, which I am right now, or I might just decide to get up and walk away. I can do that because I've let go of the chair. And that is important to remember with regard to what's going on in our bodies and minds as well. It's not, again, that I'm throwing away a personality, an identity, my gender, my anything. I'm just being willing to let it go and make use of it when it's necessary, when it's good, when it's appropriate, and not being, again, pushed around by it or controlled by it. It's just being willing to sit still in the midst of it, look at it, ask, what is the reality of this thing? What is really here? And in that way, we begin to find this deeper place within ourselves where we don't have to hold on to anything. If you continue thus, neither action nor non-action arise as distinct of themselves, and so there is no inflexibility. Few indeed understand this, most suffering from delusion. This is again points to that idea. We don't have to do any particular thing. There is no roadmap or ideal way of responding to the world. It's really just sit still. What is good to do here? How do I respond to this condition? It takes a while to really understand that that is, has a deeply profound implication and how to do that in a way that is deeply expressive of this letting go. But for every one of us, that possibility exists. The Zen trainee can gain enlightenment if he reflects upon himself from the center of his being. It is my sincere hope that you will not take pride in gaining the true way. And which is really great. Each one of us, just by sitting still, reflecting on our being from this, reflecting on our lives from the center of our being, practicing Zazen, keeping the precepts, we can realize enlightenment. And what he's saying is, and then at that end, it is my sincere hope that you will not take pride in gaining the true way. This is not just the adoption of another personality. This is not something I can say, oh, there's a new me now. Okay, and you'd be surprised at how often that, well, maybe you wouldn't be surprised, but that is a definite pitfall that people can fall into. I've had this experience, now I see how to be, now I can be a new self, and look at me, okay? Dogen's saying, even go beyond that, continue to let go. That is where, that is how, that is where a Zen trainee behaves. That is where a Zen trainee behaves from. Just let go. And I think that's all I have to say today. Do you have any questions?
I did earlier.
Okay.
Oh, I think I know what it was. So if you have, how would you explain, or could you clarify, if someone has goals, if they have things they would like to achieve, whether it be personally, financially, family, whatever, how does that work? I know a lot of times we say, and y'all encourage, run it by the precepts. However, how can we incorporate that in order to improve ourselves in certain areas, the goals that we have, but also to exhibit Zen behavior?
Well, it's a really good question, and I think there, to my way of thinking, there is no inherent problem with having such goals, with just being a regular human being and doing the practical things in life, improving ourselves, learning how to do various things, whatever it may mean, you know, improving our physical fitness, doing any of those kinds of things. And it's really just a matter of, to me, taking up those things with the mind of meditation and looking at them from the perspective of meditation, of just, you know, as you decide to learn Tai Chi, you'd think to yourself, okay, I'm getting older, I need to kind of do some physical fitness, I'm gonna learn this martial art Tai Chi, and so you go into that with all of the human kind of desire to be good at it and learn it well and all that stuff, and that's just fine. It's just a matter of making it your practice in a sense, and allowing it and being still within it and looking at it from the perspective of meditation and looking at how it affects your life and whether or not you want to have that effect in your life, just being aware of it and going forward in that sense. So to me, I don't see an obstacle to doing any of those things, and within them providing them, you know, kind of doing them from the mind of meditation. But maybe Reverend Master Rooks on it.
I remember something Reverend Master Daiswi wrote about his early years coming to Shasta when he was a graduate student in Eugene, Oregon, and Shasta was quite a drive from there. And his trying to get down there and continue with graduate work and how difficult it was and how he kind of felt pulled into, etc. Until he finally changed his point of view and realized that he wasn't a graduate student or however else he wanted to describe himself in this context, trying to practice or trying to learn Zen or Buddhism. But he was a Buddhist who happened to be a graduate student and whatever else was going on in his life. And so in my experience, these goals are fine as long as you keep them in mind, keep training in mind. For example, when you get into the, you know, oh my gosh, my Tai Chi class is coming up, I've got to get there, how am I going to get there, I'm going to be late, this is, you know, I've got to feed myself, or I've got to, you know, deal with, and it's that have to kind of thing. Number one, that's potential. In other words, that it's the grasping after that can lead to suffering, can lead to difficulty, and it's also when the goals come out of selfishness rather than out of training that they can lead to difficulties. But if the goals arise from your training, in a sense you're a Buddhist first, then they're rarely ongoing difficulties that are difficult to deal with. Or at least that's my experience. When they arise out of, I'm going to do this so I can be a millionaire, you know, with no other desire than fame and gain, then you may well find that you have problems arising from that. I don't know if that...
Yeah, I think the conflict I have is, time put into trying to balance it all, but having the goals of, okay, I have a lot of debt and it's stressful, and the way to go about that is to set some goals to not only decrease some spending but make some more money, and there's ways I can do that, but at what point, you know, I don't want it to be all consuming so that I don't have the priority or my family, yet I do have those goals. And I guess it's just, you know, it's, I don't want to have a lot of internal conflict about it. I would like to feel I guess at peace, or feel like I don't want to feel so selfish about it.
Well,
I'm just trying to figure that out.
One of the things in Buddhism, one of the things we're trying to help people understand, and this goes right to the heart of practicing the precepts, being a Buddhist is being a responsible human being. And I'm not saying that having debt is irresponsible, but paying back debt is really is really the responsible thing. There's a kind of perceptual issue there. And again, I'm not trying to point any fingers at you, but we can, and that's part of what Rivermaster Roxon's pointing out, I think, is when a thing comes out of our practice, part of that lack of peace is, well, I need to pay back this debt. And in order to do that, we may well have to make sacrifices. We may have to do something that's difficult to do. And there's no obstacle, there's no problem with that. And you might even have to say, well, in order to pay back this debt within this amount of time, I might have to sacrifice going to the priory as often as I would like during this particular time. Making sure that you set aside some time for yourself other times, you know, to meditate or do whatever. Because if we don't kind of maintain our religious practice, then it starts to diffuse, and our deeper peace of mind then is eroded. But there's also another thing that comes to mind when we're talking. So being responsible is very important, I think. There's another thing, which is that in our culture today, we have this sort of obsession with doing stuff. And there is a kind of a way in which, unless we're hyperactive in being in this club or doing that kind of activity and running our kids all over creation, better not get into that, but then we're not really being good citizens or good whatever. And we really have to look carefully at that. We really have to look carefully at that and ask ourselves, is this really coming from my practice? And by practice, I mean from my own sense of meditation, my own heart of meditation, my own sense of what's good for me to do. Or is that coming from other kinds of fear-related things, like am I doing all this activity because I'm afraid of being by myself, or am I afraid of censure from my friends, or afraid of, you know, all these different things? And we have to really be willing to look at that and look at how we're motivated by this kind of social pressure or personal internal pressure to do things, and be willing to not do as much in that external way as well. Does that make mm-hmm. sense?
No, yeah. Another aspect is be careful mm-hmm. about how you think you should feel mm-hmm. about this.
Right.
Just because you're feeling conflicted mm-hmm. or confused or agitated doesn't mean there's a problem with what you're doing. It simply could be these feelings are arising. Mm-hmm. Be careful about being judgmental about what you're doing because the feelings are arising. Mm-hmm. Be careful about being judgmental about the feelings. It may be good when these feelings arise to ask yourself, well, in fact, is it good to do this? And as long as through your training, through doing your best, it still appears, it still comes up, it still feels to be good to do this, and you might want to talk to one of us or take refuge in someone else whose opinion you respect, then it may be good to simply accept the feelings and not become too involved in them. That's not to say you don't experience them, but be careful using them as your guide to what you're doing. And if they present some helpful information, that's fine. And this is all part of doing the best that we can. This is all part of seeing what arises. But, you know, at times you get a feeling that whatever is good to do, and it may scare the hell out of you.
Yeah, and it reminds me of another thing that Reverend Rokozan's talking about. Our feelings are the result of past actions, and we may go through periods where we feel lousy or whatever, or anxious or whatever, because of our past choices. Now, what I'm going to say is not actually, I have no idea what your particular situation is. I'm just talking to a general condition that I have observed in the world today. There's this idea that we can, and it has to do with financial debt, there's this idea that we can get what we want, put it on the credit card, and deal with it later. And to a certain extent, I mean, I have my own credit card, I do that, well, I pay off my credit card every month, but anyway, I do that to a certain extent. And you know, we make mortgages, we buy cars, we have things that we need. So there's not a problem with the basic presumption. But in our country, as we've seen, kind of politically, we've gone overboard on that. We've unrealistically accumulated debt that we can't really pay off. I saw this with my dad. He actually declared bankruptcy 3 times in his life. And he could just never get it that he needed to be able to spend money according to the money that was coming in. He just never could quite figure that out. And it was quite sad because he would find himself nearly suicidal at times because of the accumulating debt that he was getting. So, and those are negative feelings that he had produced for himself by his willingness to get into debt. So part of the thing about then, once you realize, oh, I need to pay off debt, is that you may actually feel the consequences of your debt. I mean, in the sense of, this is earning this amount of money is difficult. And it has other significances in terms of my life. And we need to, when we sign the bottom line and say, okay, I'm going to accept this debt, we need to understand that it will take work to repay that, and we'll have to pay that work over, you know, time. And as we all know, work is work in the physics sense, going up a hill, is difficult. if you see what I'm getting at. And there's nothing, as long as we go into that relationship soberly, there's nothing wrong with that, in the sense that Master Rokudan's talking about. There's nothing wrong with those feelings that come up as a result of doing work. And we just have to recognize, oh, this is part of the consequence of my signing the bottom line. And again, I'm not trying to say that you've done anything wrong or anything like that, you know, kind of personally, just talking to this kind of wider issue.
I look at it as, I feel like there's been so many, you know, we all have our habits, and it's, we have habits and cons, and I guess some of them can be both or crossover, but it's been something that has been, you know, out of control, or just not dealt with, or procrastinated, whatever, you know, all those habits, you know, and also my viewpoints of, you know, I don't want to feel like this, I should feel, you know, all those, again, the habits of how I process things, and I want it to stop,
and
but I have to have do
to be,
something.
That's
about.
Where you have to be careful mm-hmm. about, and that's when we talked about accepting and embracing, because as long as I found I want it to stop,
right,
all I was doing was increasing the amount of suffering and getting very little control mm-hmm. over it. So it was not only not working, it was making me hurt more. It was just weird, and why would I continue with this?
Right.
But when you truly accept that I have these habits, I have these opinions, I have these ways of doing things, and they are causing problems for mm-hmm. me.
Not only me, my family.
Absolutely. When you bow to that, when you accept that, when you embrace that, when you even find some compassion mm-hmm. for that, I don't know how to say it, you can embrace the mistake and feel compassionate and even some love to it, because it's trying to help on some delusional level. Nevertheless, it's really trying to help.
This is why I would emphasize. See, what Reverend Rokudan's saying here is, I want it to stop. Mm-hmm. And as Buddhists, or as people who have encountered the Buddha Dharma, what we're saying is, I want it to stop. And what I'm going to do in order to make it stop is I'm going to train. I'm going to apply the Dharma. And that's my method to wanting it to stop, not trying to push
control,
it away, control,
or, yeah,
do all of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I'm going to apply training. And that's why I would say, even though you might have to at some point say, I can't go to the priory as much or whatever, it's really critical, imperative that you keep up your own mm-hmm. meditation and the application of the precepts and your cultivation of your training. In that way, as your own personal, I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with me, although it benefits me as another human being in the world. It's just for our own personal benefit. This is the opportunity of the Dharma, that the presence of the Dharma gives us. Here is a way that we can actually make that stop. There's a great thing, there's a great dialogue between Angulimala, who was a mass murderer, literally killed 999 people before he became a Buddhist, and the Buddha. And Angulimala decided to make the Buddha his 1,000th person that he was going to kill. He had this job of collecting 1,000 finger bones. And so he's running along this path, trying to catch the Buddha to kill him. And the Buddha is kind of just walking along, but always maintaining his being outside of Angulimala's ability to catch him. And Angulimala is saying, "Stop! Stop!" And the Buddha turned and said, "I have stopped, Angulimala. You need to stop." And Angulimala just kind of went, "Oh, you know, what do you mean by that?" And that was the beginning of his relationship, where he realized, ah, the Buddha has stopped. The Buddha has put down those habits. The Buddha has practiced and trained his mind to put down those impulses that go on. And Angulimala, the mass murderer, needs to learn how to do that himself. Okay. And we're all in that position of being the mass murderer in one way or another. And so, again, just to say, it's very important for us to get to the point where I have to stop. And that's where our training can really be of most benefit, because that's our method.
And I do believe that that will be the key to figuring it out, or just keep on going.
You just have to keep at it, and have the faith that will be enough. You really, as long as you really are cultivating the will to train, you really are cultivating the meditation and the precepts, that will be enough. It will change. You will get where you hope you'll get. It may look different than you anticipate.
I'm trying not to have expectations.
And when the expectations arise, bow to them, accept them, embrace them, recognize that they're there and that they color the way you look at the world. They're okay. And on some level, they are very helpful because they keep us going. You know, and they do give information, and we can continue to measure our expectations against reality. That's okay, and recognize what they are. You know, they're not necessarily real, and as long as we treat them, as long as we treat them as not necessarily real, rather than this is absolutely real and I'm bad or wrong or whatever because it's not occurring, then, you know, they can actually help us to train.
Well, I know I was talking to my father yesterday, and I tried to tell my husband and my son, because even my son fusses at, we don't need to do this, we need to do this. I keep telling him, I said, Weston, you're a slave driver. Because he's become, I don't know what, he's just very regimented now. It's like really weird hearing that from a teenager, you know. And you know, my son says, "Well, I'm trying to advise you." And I said, "Well, I understand that, you know, I appreciate that." I said, "But I could use constructive criticism instead of just criticism." But I tried to tell him, he said, "Well, you know, I'm better at handling my money than you are. And I said, yes, you are, you know. And I said, I'm not blaming it on my parents, but I had two examples that weren't good role models. And I just talked to my dad yesterday, and I got just that feedback again. My dad said, well, I can't do this because, and it all had to do with the same thing he's been doing over and over his whole life. Well, I can't do this because I'm waiting for this closing, and then I got to pay that debt off. So I thought, he hasn't changed. He's almost 70, or is 70-something years old.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be like that. I don't.
Yeah.
I don't want to live like that. And yet I realize that I'm headed down the same path, and it causes friction in their household, my dad and my stepmom. And it's like, I have to break this cycle. Fortunately, my son has so far turned out differently. My daughter has picked up some of my habits, though. You know, burning a hole in her pocket. You know, the money can't sit there.
Well, you know, not that I want to kind of psychoanalyze your family or anything
right.
like that, but...
But these are real problems
sure.
that cause real stress.
And from the point of training, and again, back to what Reverend Master Rokazan's talking about, from the point of view of training, we either go... I mean, actually, it's not surprising to me that Weston is becoming quite regimented, becoming a fascist in a way. because that is the... That is, in a sense, the worldly response mm-hmm. to being out of control with whatever it is.
Right.
We become control freaks. And in terms of meditation, there's really, in terms of training, in terms of our deep peace of mind, there really isn't that much difference between the two. I mean, there is a slight advantage to being a control freak in that you have learned to grasp your will and to take charge of circumstances. But usually that goes far beyond the call of necessity, and then you become addicted to control. And so in terms of training, even though it may not look elegant, or it may not look like, you know, it may not be satisfactory to someone like Weston, there is actually, it's deeply important to be willing to go into it with the willingness to let go and do what is good. That makes sense, because we, in a certain way, we need to learn how to grasp our will and say, this has to stop, and I'm going to stop it, and then take the step into meditation where you have to say, please help me, I'm willing to do what needs to be done, and both of those things need to happen. But so, yeah,
and we wish you well.